From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief. State of Belief can be heard across the country weekends on Air America Radio. The program and this podcast are made possible by Interfaith Alliance and its members. For more information on Interfaith Alliance and its work promoting faith and freedom throughout America, visit interfaithalliance.org. And while you're there, please consider supporting State of Belief and this free podcast service by making a tax-deductible donation to Interfaith Alliance Foundation. We need your help to keep State of Belief on the air. Thank you for listening.
Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently. Here's your host, the Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Welcome, everyone, to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy, president of the Interfaith Alliance, broadcasting this week from the Radio People Studios in my hometown, Monroe, Louisiana. Well, it's been a bad week for turkeys. I hope it's been a good week for you. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. On today's show, we will give thanks of our own. Every year, here at Interfaith Alliance, we offer an award to a person or a group of people whose actions have embodied the values of civility, tolerance, diversity, and who have advanced public dialogue on controversial or divisive issues. We call it our Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award. Later in the show, we'll revisit my conversations with two of this year's honorees, religious leader Rabbi Irwin Kula and journalist Asra Nomani. Plus, stay tuned to hear some of my own thoughts on gratitude and what I'm personally thankful for this year. But first, for a show that focuses on religious liberty, we'd be remiss in not remembering that the Pilgrim Voyage to America was prompted by a desire to establish religious freedom while maintaining a cultural identity. But have the religious and cultural identities of the Pilgrim settlers been maintained? To find out, we went straight to the source, Plymouth, Massachusetts, home to the original Pilgrim colony. And we found that the first congregation of the Pilgrims is still operating. Now, I'd like to share with you now an interview that I did on a past Thanksgiving with the Reverend Sarah Clark, pastor of First Parish Church, which is a Unitarian Universalist congregation now. First Parish is the first Pilgrim congregation. But I asked Reverend Clark, is it the only one?
No, First Parish was gathered in 1606 in Scrooby, England. And in 1800, the parish split up again. And so we have the Church of the Pilgrimage, which actually is right next door to us, that also is directly descended from the Pilgrims. And we also, First Parish birthed some churches as people moved out to other communities.
Now, are all of these Unitarian Universalist congregations?
No. Second Parish in Manomet is UCC, and so is Church of the Pilgrimage, United Church of Christ.
Sarah, how different is modern-day Unitarian Universalism from the theology that the Pilgrims brought to this nation?
It is different in some ways and very similar in others.
Could you give us a brief course?
We're not Calvinistic, but the words of Pastor John Robinson when they left Holland were to them, "The Lord hath more truth and light to break forth from his holy word." And he said to them, don't stick with what Luther has said. Don't stick with what Calvin has said. Don't even stay with what I've said. That religion is, in other words, is always changing. And those words are still emblazoned, actually, on our church. In years past, in the 400 years, when our religion has changed, and when we turn to become more liberal Christians as opposed to Orthodox Christians, and then at the time when we have become really not Christian, although we have many Christians among us, we've taken that as the words that we follow, that there's always more truth than light, that religion is always changing and that we have to be open to accept the truth and light that is to come.
Reverend Sarah Clark, thanks for giving us this little history lesson on State of Belief, and I hope you have a happy Thanksgiving.
You too.
On today's show, we're talking about giving thanks, and me, I'm particularly thankful for the opportunity I've had to serve as president of the Interfaith Alliance. As president, I get to oversee a variety of different projects. And one of my favorite is a summer program that we hold every year here in Washington, D.C. Teenagers from all over the country gather in Washington, D.C. to learn about the importance of religious freedom and to celebrate their own diversity. We call the program the LEAD Camp. And looking back on what I'm thankful for, I must count LEAD and the eager young students who participate in it as one of this year's blessings. State of Belief visited LEAD this past summer, and here's a look back at what some of the participants had to say.
My name is Denny Davidoff, and I'm the director of the LEAD program as a senior consultant to the Interfaith Alliance Foundation. The LEAD program is an immersion in the issues of religious liberty in this country. It is designed for high school students, and we teach them about how the founders came to write the First Amendment, and we do a lot of work around the First Amendment with particular emphasis on those clauses.
I'm just curious, how many, just raise your hand if you've been in a situation where somebody has been basically discriminated against.
My name is Abel Gilbert, and I am from Brandon, Florida. I am Roman Catholic. I came to LEAD because one of my closest friends had recommended it, first of all, and hearing about what LEAD and the Interfaith Alliance is all about, I became very, very interested because coming here to America, first of all, I know firsthand how different it is. You know, this entire world is filled with diversity, and coming here would be an amazing experience, like it has been, for me to learn more and grow as a person. Getting to know these different cultures, religions, and faiths.
Exactly, yes. What you're asking for, but one of my best friends is Jewish, and we were learning about world religions, and we didn't have any Jewish kids in our class. So she.
Hi, I'm Lauren Carroll, and I'm from Phoenix, Arizona. I had a friend who came here last year, and he told me about the experience, and it just sounded really great and like something I would love to do. That's why I decided to come, because everyone who has come already sounded like they had a great time.
And that day we had a substitute teacher, and she was constantly being interrupted by him.
You know, in these sessions where we're all telling deeply personal stories, because religion is a deeply personal subject, it's really great to know that because we're all excited to be here and we're all eager to learn, that we're comfortable with each other and open to teaching each other about our beliefs and learning about other people. And even though we've only been here a week, we're all incredibly close, so there's really no restrictions in what we're able to be open about with each other.
One thing I noticed is that whenever I watch the news, 99% of the times when you see Muslim or Islam, it won't be Muslim or Islam, it'd be Muslim terrorists or Islamic terrorism.
Hi, my name is Jamal Barakat. I'm from Moorpark, California, right by LA, and I follow Islam. Me and my friends, we don't really talk about religion, so it's nice to come here and talk about it and see other people's views and clear stuff up.
Well, all throughout my younger childhood, I've been told by adults that I was going to go to hell because I was Buddhist.
You know, I came in here thinking I had a pretty good knowledge of different religions, and then I came here and I learned so much more that I didn't even think to ask before.
I learned a lot more, like for example, last night in the question answer session that we had about the Sikh religion. I have personally heard very, very little about him, and I'm very fascinated, actually.
Last year, I remember as one of our students was leaving, she said to me, I'm very, very close to my family, and I have talked about things with these new friends this week that I have never even discussed with my family. So that's one of the things that happens here.
Yeah. Speak first. Oh, so Maddie, and then Molly, and
you know, we can definitely just relate to each other. And yeah, we just became a nice little family in the little week that we've been here. So
the people who were here in 2006 are all still in touch with each other. They know that they can count on the support of the Interfaith Alliance staff. You just one by one create a hopefully a national movement for pluralism and for understanding and for defenders of religious liberty, which is all about what the mission of the Interfaith Alliance is about.
I'm Welton Gaddy. This is State of Belief. Up next, I speak with religious leader Rabbi Erwin Kula. Get some cold turkey if you must, but please come back. Stick around. You want to hear this. Again, everybody, I'm Welton Gaddy, and this is State of Belief. Thank you for tuning in this Thanksgiving weekend. Every year, the Interfaith Alliance, the organization of which I'm president, gives thanks of its own, thanks to people whose work advances the ideals of tolerance and civility and diversity. We call the award the Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award, and this year's honorees included Judy Shepherd, a woman who's worked tirelessly on the issue of hate crimes after her own son, Matthew Shepherd, was brutally murdered for being gay. We also gave awards to journalist Asra Nomani and to Rabbi Erwin Kula. And in addition to honoring Rabbi Kula with a Cronkite Award, I was fortunate to be able to speak with him here on State of Belief. Rabbi Erwin Kula is the president of the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership. I spoke with Rabbi Kula at the time of the release of his book, Yearnings, Embracing the Sacred Messiness of Life. Now, who wouldn't want to read that? Take a listen back to our conversation. We're talking with Rabbi Erwin Kula, who is the author of a book with a fascinating title, Yearnings, and the subtitle is Embracing the Sacred Messiness of Life. Now, you know, most people don't think of sacred and messiness together. How did you get those together, and what's it mean?
Actually, I got it together the first time. A story, when I was 9 years old, I and my brother were fighting. You know, like siblings do. I have five younger brothers. And I pushed my brother, and he went into the wall and made a hole in the wall. And it was exactly the shape of his behind, actually, because of the way I pushed him. We knew we were going to be in trouble. We tried to hide it from my parents. About 3 days later, after pillows had covered it, my mother comes in and says, "What is that, actually?" And we got in trouble, but this is what my mother did. She brought up a bucket of art supplies about 2 hours later. I mean, and we were pretty nervous in the room waiting. And she told us to decorate the dent. And I grew up, but we didn't have enough money to get the wall fixed. So for about a year, we lived there in that room with this decorated dent. Mm. And I think that's the first place I realized that messiness and dents and the problems actually are also opportunities to create beauty. And then I think my life has led me to recognize that if we mean by, what we really mean by sacred is a kind of life intensity, then actually, if we're very honest, the disappointments, the discontent, the messiness in our lives always lead to greater depth. I'm not saying we want it, mm-hmm. and I'm not prescribing it, mm-hmm. and I'm not saying we're punished, and that all I'm saying is that given what can't be changed, the messiness very often does lead to depth.
Now, I think you draw heavily on what you call the wisdom traditions. In fact, you see in the wisdom traditions ways of responding to people's search for meaning and truth in all kinds of situations in life. First of all, tell our listeners what that means. What are the wisdom traditions?
Wisdom traditions for me is are the ancient traditions that have been handed down to us. You can think of, let's think about 15, 20 of the major ones. You know, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism. And they are not, yes, they're religious traditions, But there's deep wisdom within all of them that are actually independent of the group itself. Mm-hmm. So for me, for example, to be able to, as a rabbi, eighth generation rabbi, to access, for example, the Sacred Heart. Now, I don't have to be Christian to access the wisdom in that symbol. The wisdom in that symbol is, oh my God, wow, my heart can be that open? The idea is so profound, it's so wise that I can have access to it as a Jew, independent of, I don't have to become Christian. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's true for all the wisdom traditions. And one of the things that's happened, the wisdom has got embedded in a lot of creed and dogma and therefore is not out there. And America needs wisdom.
For people in our nation who have a suspicion about religion or maybe even some hostility toward religion because of the way they've been hurt by it, does this wisdom literature, the wisdom sayings, do they transcend religion itself?
You know, it's a good question. And what I'd say is there are a lot of people who have been hurt by religion. And I think by loosening a little bit the wisdom from the religious group building, I think there's a healing part of that. You know, the great stories and narratives of all of our traditions, some of the amazing practices of our tradition, they are healing. Unfortunately, they came for a lot of us with a lot of bad baggage. So I think this is part of re-entering religion, religious wisdom, into the conversation of America, which is desperate for it. Right now, it seems to me, we have kind of secular fundamentalists on the one hand who if you even talk about religion, they freak out. That is not good for a country. And on the other hand, we have the reaction to that, which is people who are, they are so sure of themselves. We can call them religious fundamentalists, but they're so sure of themselves that it feels oppressive and coercive.
How do you address the subject of religious wisdom if religion is a part of the problem?
Well, I would say two things. One is we have one side on this debate that says it's so messy, therefore keep it in the privacy of your home. Make sure it doesn't come out because it is primitive and homophobic and racist and xenophobic, and that's religion. And then you got the other side that says, no. Religion's not messy. If everyone would just do what I say, it's not messy at all, life. What we have to do, and in this respect, we are on the avant-garde doing this, and it is lonely to do it, is to say, of course religion is messy. Anything real life is messy, whether it's politics, whether it's love. So religion is real messy. On the other hand, it is a powerful, healing, wise force, too.
I'm Welton Getty, and you were just listening to my conversation with Rabbi Irwin Kula, author of Yearnings, Embracing the Sacred Messiness of Life. Rabbi Kula is the president of the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership, and he was a recipient of this year's Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award given by my organization, the Interfaith Alliance. For more information on the award, go to our website, interfaithalliance.org. But don't go there right this moment, because up next on State of Belief, I'll share my interview with a woman whom I've called a modern-day saint. Don't go anywhere. You don't find a lot of saints these days. And when you find one, it's good to listen. We'll be right back. Everybody, I'm Welton Getty, and this is State of Belief. In November of 2003, Asra Nomani became the first woman in her West Virginia mosque to insist on the right to pray in the main hall, where traditionally seating is reserved only for males. "We're standing up for our rights as women in Islam," she said. "We will no longer accept the back door or the shadows. At the end of the day, we'll be leaders in the Muslim world." Asra Nomani is a former Wall Street Journal correspondent and currently a professor of journalism at Georgetown University. She is a passionate activist on behalf of Muslim women, as illustrated in her book, Standing Alone in Mecca, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. and she's a loyal friend and colleague, continuing to investigate the death of her co-worker, Daniel Pearl. After hearing Asra Nomani speak at an event sponsored by the Jewish Theological Seminary, I told my congregation here in Monroe, Louisiana, that I felt I had been in the presence of a contemporary saint, a person whose work in Islam is as important, if not more so, than the reformative work done by Martin Luther within Christianity. Appropriately enough, we honored Asra Nomani this year with a Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award, an award which the Interfaith Alliance grants to people whose work advances the values of tolerance and civility. I was lucky to have Asra not only as a recipient of the award, but also as a guest here on State of Belief. I want you to take a listen back to my conversation with Asra Nomani, and as you will hear, Asra immediately commented on my use of the words contemporary saint to describe her.
Your introduction reminds me of when I was walking on the streets of Lucknow in India, and a jeweler who was Hindu said to me, looked me in the eye and said, "You will either be a sinner or a saint." And I feel like that's sort of the choices for all of us, right?
I think so, though. I think most of us are a combination of that.
I know, exactly. I'll hopefully send him a telepathic message that at least one person thinks I'm doing okay.
Even in Western culture, it's surprising for many people to hear the term feminist Muslim.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, I mean, sadly, the Muslim world in the 21st century is just in the dark ages when it comes to the status of women. And I think that we are actually practicing an Islam that is in contradiction to the early teachings in the 7th century. For example, in the 7th century, the Prophet Muhammad built a mosque in the city of Medina, and women participated freely. We had a Florence Nightingale who had a corner of the mosque, and she would help the wounded. We had women who would challenge the Prophet in, you know, edicts that he would talk about. And now in the 21st century, in mosques in America, it said in a survey that 2 out of 3 mosques require that a woman be behind a curtain, a wall. Some cases it's even as lame as a shower curtain, like they throw that up. Sometimes it's a one-way mirror. And I think a natural evolution is going to inevitably happen in the Muslim world. It just hasn't fully been realized yet.
But you know, Asra, you've made what I think is a profoundly important point, and that is that the basis of your leadership in feminism is not coming from an effort to modernize Islam. It's coming from an effort to recover the essential integrity of Islam at its inception.
Yeah, and I see, you know, that our Christian and Jewish brothers and sisters are doing the same. I mean, because at the end of the day, you know, we're all struggling as individuals and as society with these drives, you know, of greed, consumerism, loathing, hatred, all of these things that take us away from faith, I think the best of faith. And as individuals, we face these challenges, and then as societies, we face them. And so now in our Muslim world, what you will hear from the critics of women and men also who are trying to reclaim these early teachings is that we are changing the religion, and that we're trying to create, for example, when we're in America, an American brand of Islam. But basically, what we're doing is challenging their interpretation.
Asra, I want to talk a little bit about your experiences with Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl. I know that your interest in his case is far more than professional. Would you tell our listeners a little bit about your connection with Danny Pearl?
Yeah, Danny was a great friend of mine from our days together in the Washington Bureau of the Wall Street Journal. We both bonded very quickly over beach volleyball behind the Lincoln Memorial. And my friendship with Danny was representative of the best that happens when we make friends across typical boundaries. You know, he was a son of Jewish immigrants. I was the daughter of Muslim immigrants, we didn't care that, you know, we were different according to our ethnicities and our religions. We were connected. And as your listeners know, Danny found his way to Pakistan after 9/11. I did too. And he was visiting my house when he left for that interview, from which he didn't come back. And, you know, in those 5 weeks trying to find Danny in the, you know, night of hell in which we discovered that, in fact, he had been killed, I turned a corner, you know, in my life. You know, I had been quite fun-loving and did a lot of fun stories. And when Danny died and when I saw what had been done in the name of religion, my religion, I really had my wake-up call, and that's when I knew that I wanted to stand up and write and act for an expression of Islam that was the one in which I had grown up in, that had encouraged me to be friends with this man that others had decided was an enemy.
I remember vividly your description of your emotional state, the turbulence in your mind after you found out that Danny was dead, and the worry about whether or not you should stay there, whether you should leave. And you said you called your father. Tell our listeners about that call, because I was stunned by the answer that he gave you, and I'd like you to tell the story and reflect on why he said that.
So I, you know, had been targeted in the Pakistani media as a spy for India, and we were under protection, they said, guards everywhere around my house, but I didn't know if we were under protection or under house arrest. You know, we just basically couldn't go outside of our house for even a walk. I called my father to ask him what I should do, what he felt whether I should stay or go. And he said, it is your farz, it is your duty to remain and look for your friend. And this, to me, was just so clear from a man who has a little mark on his forehead. I call it sort of the gang sign of a really devout Muslim, because his forehead has just hit the ground so many times in his lifetime in prostration that they get this mark. And he's a man devoted to his faith, and he was not at all aligned with that interpretation of Islam that says that we are not cannot be friends with the Christians or the Jews, but it's in fact the contrary. I mean, he believes that we are human and we have an allegiance to each other as humans.
My guess is, Asra, that a lot of times when you're in situations where people don't agree with you and you're defending what you're doing, that you must hear that voice stay over and over again.
Yeah, and I think that we all have folks like that in our lives, you know, teachers who have been instrumental in giving us clarity. And you know, it took me going out into the world, seeing the ugliest of humanity, you know, the darkest base of what human beings can do, to really appreciate those simple lessons that my parents had given me of truth and ethics and integrity, and to realize that we have to fight for it in the world.
Did what happened to you after Danny's death that drove you back to look at the very nature of Islam and what was going on within it, did that cause you to look at violence in Islam in the same way that you had revisited the role of women in Islam?
Oh, absolutely. You know, for decades, I was in my late 30s by then, and for the last, you know, 20 years before, I had really felt marginalized in the way my Muslim community defined itself. I would end up with my mom in the little efficiency apartments when they had potluck dinners, and you know, I really felt like this noose around my neck as a woman in my community. And I didn't challenge it because it was just easier not to challenge it. And then when Danny died, I was just reflecting on this continuum that I really felt
also affected my life as a woman in the faith, this continuum of interpretation, you know, the interpretation that says that a woman must be silent and must be behind a wall is the same, you know, on that continuum then of interpretation is the idea then that we can't be friends with the Jews and the Christians, that in fact, perhaps we should be violent towards them. And I know this, I mean, it came home to me because in the midst of trying to find Danny, we learned that the photos that the world saw of him had been dropped off at a mosque in Karachi. And, you know, the men who had done that had felt like that prayer space, that sanctuary, was legitimate space in which they could, you know, pass off these pictures of this journalist in captivity. And yet it dawned on me that I couldn't even go into that space as a woman. These men could go into there and do their dirty deeds, but I couldn't even go in there to pray. And so I knew that there was a connection in interpretation. And that's why, you know, when I fight for the role of women, it's really a fight for a peaceful, tolerant expression of Islam that would be nonviolent.
I remember, as if it were last night, the chills that I felt in hearing you describe your decision to enter the mosque in your hometown and to take your seat in what had been an area of the mosque traditionally off limits to women. And then I fought back tears when I heard you say that suddenly you felt the presence of your mother beside you. Change took place in your family. The question is, can change take place internationally?
It can, and it is. A leader in a mosque in San Francisco tore down the wall of behind which women were expected to sit and never had it return. In Chicago, four American Muslim women lawyers, you know, who had gone to the best of schools in America but been basically delegated to the closet of their mosque, protested and were named to the board by a visionary leader. We, as the younger generation, as American Muslim women, as Muslim women around the world, we're not seeking permission anymore to claim and reclaim our rights. We are taking them. And, you know, we're borrowing a page from civil disobedience all over the world. And as a movement, then, we bring about the change. And it's happening.
Asra Nomani has been our guest. She's the author of Standing Alone in Mecca, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. Asra, you give us hope.
Oh, you let us stand up with hope. So thank you for your support.
Well, thank you for being with us on State of Belief.
All right. Take care.
I'm Welton Gaddy, and you're listening to State of Belief. Coming up, I'll leave you with some of my own thoughts about Thanksgiving. Please stay tuned. Welcome back, everyone, to State of Belief. I am Welton Gaddy. A week ago on Sunday morning, around 7:30, I answered a call made to the church that I pastor here in Monroe, Louisiana. May I speak to Dr. Gaddy? That's what she called me. A lot of people pronounce my name different ways, but I answer to all of them. And when I said, "This is he," the woman began a series of comments that made me think I was about to listen to a call like one that I've heard hundreds of times before. "Dr. Gaddy," she said, "I am a black woman, not originally from here. Several years ago, I married a white man, several years older than me, who is from Monroe. It has not been easy. He is not well. I only can imagine," I thought to myself, pretty sure that I knew what was coming next and how I would have to respond. I anticipated the woman was seeking financial assistance beyond what our church could offer. It has not been easy, the woman on the other end of the phone line continued last Sunday morning. My husband has been sick a lot lately, and I'm not completely well myself. But Dr. Gady, we are so happy. My husband and I feel so fortunate, so richly blessed to have each other. We really love each other. Early this morning, my husband and I decided that we wanted to share our gratitude with someone who might care and ask that person to give thanks with us. After I hung up the phone, I sat thinking about what had just happened as a genuine act of giving thanks. Genuine gratitude is an expression of the heart that comes not by comparison. You know, well, things could be worse. We're better off than a lot of other people, so we'll give thanks. Neither does such gratitude come from a declaration from the President of the United States telling us we need to pray. I don't want anyone telling me when to pray. Authentic thanksgiving comes from an experience such as the one conveyed by that woman with whom I talked a week ago. Even in a tough time, amid sickness and experiences of prejudice, a woman and her husband found joy in each other to such an extent that they wanted to share it. Out of my own experiences, I'm thankful for a democratic process that works despite all of the influences that could cripple it. I'm thankful for the precious gift of religious liberty and a stackpole of rights and liberties that derive from it. I'm thankful for the privilege of working surrounded by the blessings of diversity. And I'm thankful that every week I get to enjoy the privilege of speaking to an incredibly attentive and supportive audience like those of you who regularly tune in to State of Belief. You know, I don't even have to enjoy a special day and a special dinner to relish those sources of gratitude. But yes, let me be clear, I did eat well on Thanksgiving Day. Well, friends, that's our show for this week. Be sure to tune in next week when I'm back with all new guests and new conversations. But do be in touch with us in the meantime and tell us what you thought of this week's show. Go to stateofbelief.com to send us your thoughts. And while you're there, you could read our new blog or visit our show archives and post on our message boards. As always, I must remind you that State of Belief is produced by Interfaith Alliance Foundation, a not-for-profit organization, which means this show is supported by members of Interfaith Alliance. Go to interfaithalliance.org to learn more. While you're there, think about becoming more than a listener. We'd love to have you as a member of the Interfaith Alliance. Your membership can help State of Belief stay on the air. Now, I'll be back next weekend, and I hope you will also. But until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Reverend Welton Gady, and that's State of Belief. Billy Ray was a preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along.
State of Belief, religion and radio done differently.